So this is being recorded, so I'll use the mic, even though I could come closer and you could hear. So I think I know most of everyone in the room, maybe. My name's Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with Jewish studies, and welcome to this year's Ada Finifter Memorial Lecture. Annette Frum is the author of the book, We Are Few, Folklore and Ethnic Identity of the Jews of Yanina, Greece. So right now, the library's copy of that book is in the exhibit that's just outside the door here. That exhibit's on loan from the Kehila Kedosha Yanina Synagogue and Museum in New York, and it's only going to be on display through Sunday. So if you haven't looked at it, come this weekend. It'll probably be still there on Monday a little bit. And I wanted to thank Ronti Junis, who is the library's liaison to the MSU Museum Studies Program, for helping to install the exhibit, and of course to the MSU Jewish Studies Program for making the exhibit and this event possible. We also want to thank the Michigan State University Museum, the MSU Museum Studies Program, and the Michigan Traditional Arts Program for also participating in bringing Annette here. So we're really glad to have Annette from here tonight, and she's going to lead us further in learning about Greek Jews. Some of us began last year with last year's lecture, and we're really excited to delve in deeper this year. Annette has a PhD in folklore from Indiana University, and she's currently coordinator of the Graduate Certificate Program in Museum Studies and Assistant Professor of Museum Studies at Florida International University and the Patricia and Philip Frost Art Museum, and she's a recent Fulbright recipient. So Annette, we're so glad to have you here.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you everyone for being here. Like Deborah, I would like to thank the library for their support of this program and Michigan State University Museum Studies Program, as well as the Jewish Studies Program and Ken Walzer. I got an email out of the blue from someone saying, would you come and speak? And I said, sure, this would be an honor. And when I started learning more about Dr. Ada Finifter, I found out more that we have in common. Her maternal grandfather, Leon Cochimiro, was an immigrant to the United States from Yanina in the early 20th century. My maternal grandparents, Joseph Bacola and Esther Cohen, also immigrated from this part of Greece at the same time. Dr. Finifter's brother recently met relatives in Athens. I read that in the synagogue newsletter. And he met members of the Salvador Bacola family. So I wrote to my cousins in Greece, and I said, is that a family of ours? Because we're Bacolas, or Bacolai, as they call us. And I heard that Mr. Bacola used to call my cousin, cousin. So we're somehow distant cousins. So that means Dr. Finifter and I were somehow distant cousins. Also, I read that Dr. Finifter was, in the early days, served in the Peace Corps. She taught in Caracas, Venezuela from 1963 to 1974. 10 years later, I served in the Peace Corps in Kingston, Jamaica. The world of the Yanidan Jews is very, very small. It's very interesting. So this evening, we're going to go to Greece. And those of you who know Greece have been to places like this, and this is what Greece is, sparkling whitewashed islands, or fabulous, the Athens moons is amazing, archaeological sites. But we're going to go, and I must ask you please to excuse me, some of my slides are fuzzy. It's not your eyes. You don't always get good quality copying off the internet. But we're going to go to northwestern Greece, Epirus. Just above it is Albania. This is the whole province. Oops, I'm supposed to do that. And we're going to the city of Yanina. And you'll see it's spelled many ways, and I'll explain that later. And what I'd like to talk about is the expressive culture, the traditional culture that was indelibly shaped by the history of this community. And I'll start with talking about history. And we're going to also see the plural character of the population as reflected in the tradition of the Jews of that city. This was a multicultural area, as we would say today, pluralistic. And that's reflected in the Jewish community. Yanina is the capital of the region of Epirus, or Epirus. It's one of the most, it was and still is, one of the most important commercial, cultural, and intellectual centers in northwestern Greece. The town is thought to have been founded by the Byzantine Emperor Justinian in about the 6th century, and it became and remains this commercial center. And you can see it's spelled above in English letters, in the Greek, Ioannina, in formal Greek, in Demotic Greek, which is the Greek that people speak on the street every day, Yanina. The French spell it with a J, and there is a French influence in the Jewish community there because in the early 20th century, the Alliance Israélite Universelle, a French philanthropic charity, established schools there for the boys and the girls. And the Turkish call it Yanya. Why do I put Turkish there? Until 1913, this was Ottoman Empire. And that's why you can see, and you'll see more pictures of it. Oops, I always do this. The minaret of a mosque, right there. So Turkish. Well, how did the Jews get here? When did they arrive? What are the origins? The Jewish community, and I looked for a narrative, and I don't have one, but many times when you ask people whose origins are from this community, a narrative, or what we call a kernel of a narrative, just a few word sentences say, after the sack of the second temple in Jerusalem, when the Romans went back, and see here they are in the Arch of Titus, stealing all the goods from the temple, we were on shiploads to be slaves in Rome. But there was a storm, and the storm washed us ashore in Albania. And then they worked their way down to the city of Yanina. And could this memory of this legend be true? I don't believe so. This is, again, the region on Lake Panvotis, which is the largest lake in the Balkans. Close to present-day Yanina, there's archaeological remains of the sanctuary of Dodona. This site, you know, it's kind of like, oh, we don't get Dodoni yogurt here yet. We get Faga and others, but Dodoni is also yogurt. But anyways, this was a site devoted to Zeus, and it's probably the oldest oracle in the Greek peninsula. According to Herodotus, Dodonis probably dates to the 2nd century before the Common Era. And there was probably even an older oracle site there. There, it's said that the birthplace of the Greek-speaking tribes came from here. There was an oracle area, there was a theater, a parliament, and a sacred oak tree. If you go to the archaeology museum in Yanina, there's little strips of bronze or brass, I believe, where people would put their questions. Is my wife faithful to me? Why are my goats not giving me enough milk? Stuff like that they ask, important life-seeking questions that they ask the oracle. But there's no relationship between this archaeological site, Dodona, historically, and the present city of Yanina, even though they're somewhat close to each other. The Byzantine Empire was firmly established in Yanina. The name of the city appears in 879. And in 1319, a document described Yanina differs from the many cities in size in the excellence of its location and especially by its strength and power. But it differs from still more. It is full of inhabitants, abounds in wealth, and prides itself and excels itself in all other things as few of the Byzantine cities do. 1319. The Jewish presence in Yanina is first mentioned in the second golden bull, the Chrysovula, of Andronicus II. And in this, he writes that the sons of three Jewish serfs served the metropolitan, the religious leader of Yanina. Namer, David, and Samaria are mentioned. These were urban dwellers, and they were in service to Christian masters. We're looking 1321. Andriades, one of the people who wrote of this, said that the Jews of Yananat do not seem to have been distinguished from the Christian inhabitants, neither by their avocations, by their place of habitation. In many places, we learn of Jews and Christians living separately, and they're saying in this city, in the Byzantine period, in the 14th century, they lived together. During the Byzantine period, Yananat's population was plural, Christians, Jews, others, and the Jews probably prospered economically. The Ottoman rule is where we come to next, and what's most significant in the Ottoman rule with regard to Jewish history is the expulsion of the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula, the largest numbers of which went to the Balkans and the Levant. And what's significant about them is, as opposed to the Jews that went elsewhere to North Africa, to Northern Europe, is that they maintained a Judeo-Spanish culture. In their traditional culture, in their oral traditions, in their cooking, in their behavior and such. But these guys who went to Eastern Greece did not come over here to the West, or not in large enough numbers. The Ottoman Turks invaded Yananat in about 1431, and under their rule, the city retained a position as a capital and as a place of business. It was a gathering point. It was an entrepot for merchandise from the West that was sent on to Albania, to Western Macedonia, and Thessaly, to these eastern parts of Greece. Trade was also carried out to Vienna and to Trieste. The Jewish population of the Ottoman Greece was, as I said, primarily Sephardic, Spanish-speaking, from Spain and Portugal. However, in Yananat, they remained Greek-speaking. The most notable time period during the Ottomans was Ali Pasha, the Lion of Tepeleni, the Lion of Yananat. Under his reign, the military strength of the city's garrisons increased. His rule was over Albania and much of the western part of Greece. Trade continued to be carried on with Constantinople, Venice, Malta, and Russia. And the city was transformed into a very important urban center of pre-revolutionary Greece. An early traveler during the time of Ali Pasha said, "The merchants were traveled men, well acquainted with European habits and speaking several languages." Much of the commerce in the rest of 19th century Ottoman Empire was carried out by Jews, so we can presume that this writer was speaking of Jewish merchants. In 1431, or from 1431 until the time of Tepeleni, there were really no major events in Yananat. Ali Pasha's rule was characterized by a change in economic conditions for non-Muslims, and freedoms were rescinded, and rich Jews eventually were taxed and emigrated to Corfu, to Tripoli, to Larissa, Volos, and Thessaloniki. But the poorer Jews were treated leniently by him. And therefore, Ali Pasha used this to stabilize the Jewish populations. It was a general Ottoman way of stabilizing populations, to force people out and bring new and not allow for solidarity to grow. In 1822, as part of the Greek Revolution, Ali Pasha was killed on the island in the lake. There was a siege of the city, and finally everything settled down. But Ali Pasha lives in the memories of the Jewish community of Yananat. During Purim celebrations, it said, Ali Pasha was riding around the fortress. In the city of Yananat, there's a walled area. And he heard this noise coming from the synagogue, which was usually very quiet and staid. And as I was told, when Ali Pasha was in Yananat, everyone feared him. He was a tyrant. Every evening, he went around Yananat in the city and inside the castro, the walled area. So he was with his pishpishti, one of his functionaries, to go look what the Jews were doing. And he went inside the Yananat, the synagogue. It was the night of Purim. So he just saw the Jews, and the Jews saw him, and they got frightened. What does he want at such an hour? So he went in and he saw the Jews were there with their hands covered and they were hitting the ground. Bang, bang, bang. They were reading the Megillah In Yanina, they had a covering and they hit the ground. Haman, his children, and the rest, they said, and they hit the ground. So each one hit the ground with a covering. What are you doing, he said, with the covering at this hour? So they began to narrate how it was that there was Haman who decided to kill the Jews and to take their money. Esther was the wife of the king of Persia. So the Jews caught him to kill him, and how they had to punish Haman. So they hanged Haman. And from then on, the Jews, because they were saved, they make a holiday. Food and drink, and they drank and celebrated. Bravo, said Ali Pasha. And for how many years have you done this? How long have you done it? Well, about 2,000 years. And still you remember it and you haven't forgotten it? No, we don't forget it and we'll never forget it. Okay, do your job, he said and left. And he said, Shalom, Chronia Pola, which means many years. And we don't say Gudyantif. I'm sorry, I can't say that because I grew up saying Chronia Pola. It's Greek. And he went out. Later, they say, Ali Pasha said to his pishpishti, we have to guard ourselves from the Jews because 2,000 years have passed and they haven't forgotten. They have a long memory. So we say Ali Pasha, he lives in the memory of all of Yanina. And it's all big tourism to learn about him. But this Jew, and this little tale encapsulates the identity of the community. It's a tale about Purim, the Feast of Esther. There's a very vital awareness of their own history, which is recalled at the celebration of the holiday. More importantly, it localizes the holiday. It puts a Purim celebration in Yanina in the context of a tyrant who had ruled over the Jews of Yanina. It illustrates how the memory of their long history served to ease their lives. And the recollection's almost 200 years old in the form of a narrative, and it validates memory, the memory of the position which the Jews held in Yanina to the present-day generation. We'll see that the present-day generation has shrunk and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. But with stories like this, they recall that they were significant at one time. Let's talk about population. The population of Yanina itself, at the period of Ali Pasha, at the beginning of the 19th century, was made up of Greek Christians, Turks, Albanians, Europeans, Greek Jews, Arabs, and others, Gypsies, Vlachs, who are a migrant group. The total population of the city varies. One scholar said that there were 40,000 Jews in Yanina in the early 19th century, 40,000 in this remote mountain town, city. He found two citadels, three palaces, 18 mosques, six Greek churches, and two Jewish synagogues in 1820. A French consul to the court of Ali Pasha recorded the population of about 20,000, but he found, actually it's more than that, but he found 17,000 Christians, 5,000 Turks, 1,200 Jews, 1826. A memorandum dated 1828 recorded 1,900 Christian houses, 300 Jewish houses, and 800 Turkish houses. So we see this as a significant city. By the end of the 19th century, mid-19th century, the end of the 19th century, like the rest of the Ottoman Empire, Yanina was in a marked commercial decline, and life and standing was breaking down. And this brings us to, actually, before that, the early 20th century, the first Balkan Wars, and in fact, 2013 is the centennial of the liberation of Yanina. The first Balkan Wars, 1912 to 1913, brought about the liberation of northern Greece to unite an entire Greek nation. In February 21st, 1913, the Turkish governor, Eshet Pasha, surrendered to the Greeks. The Jews of Yanina hailed the Greeks as their liberators. No other Jewish community in Greece was so politically amenable with the Greeks. They had supported the idea of Greek nationhood while under the Ottoman rule because they knew they could maintain most of their freedom under the Greeks. After liberation, in fact, Crown Prince Constantine accompanied by municipal dignitaries, visited the synagogue outside of the fortress as one of his official stops. And a Thanksgiving service was held and celebrated, honors were paid, and so forth. But the Jews weren't necessarily accepted as equals by their Christian neighbors. They felt that the Jews had had open dealings, business dealings with the Ottomans, and they resented that. At that time, 100 years ago, the city of Yanina was a population of 20,000. About 4,000 were Jews, 600 to 700 families. Many of the Jews in Yanina at that time maintained trade relations with Europe and the East. They were engaged in silk weaving, the manufacture of scarves, veils. How many of you have been to Athens? And you've seen the changing of the guard, the Evzones with their skirts on and their funny shoes, and they wear socks, the knee highs, and the Jews wove the garters that held their socks up, the Jews of Yanina. They were goldsmiths, dryers, glaziers, tinsmiths, fishermen, porters, peddlers, shoeblacks, from the best to the worst. So between the wars was a period of growth for Yanina. 3,000 Greek Christian refugees from Asia Minor were resettled there. In, I believe, 1921, the Greeks invaded Anatolia because they had this great idea to bring back the empire of Alexander, and they were roundly defeated. And so there was an exchange of population. Turks still living in Greece, Muslims, were returned to Turkey and Greek Christians to Greece. And this upset the balance of power because the Anatolian and Pontic Greeks were by and large merchants. And they took over, they wanted to take over the economic commercial role of the Jews. So 2,000 or 3,000 Greek Christians from Asia Minor settled in Yanina. And at that same time, in the teens and 20s, about 2,000 Jews in Yanina, half the population, emigrated. They went to other cities to in Greece. They went to Eretz Israel. It was not a state then. They went to European cities and to New York primarily. Also, some few went to Baltimore. And other so that's between the wars. Also, at this time, there was anti-Jewish legislation and actions, mostly against the Jews of Salonika, but it affected Jews elsewhere. One of the primary changes was that for Jews who were traditional Jews, they didn't know from Orthodox. If you were to say to a Jew from Greece, "Are you Orthodox?" that meant, "Are you Christian?" because it's the Orthodox Church. But as traditional Jews, their shops were closed on Saturday. The Greek government introduced Sunday closing days. They had to officially close their business and lose 2 days of business. This led to some of the emigration. But the National Union of Greece, the Ethnikianosis des Elladas, a fascist party, started to show its colors and bring about changes. In the late 1930s, the Jewish community of Yanina again exhibited their continued support for the nation. Early in 1939, King George II visited the city. The community requested that there be a service in his honor. And not only the synagogue was decorated, but the exterior of the Jewish homes were decorated with carpets, gold-embroidered textiles, and so forth. And he was honored by his visit. World War II. Greece was divided into three areas by the Axis powers. The green was under Bulgarian hegemony. The red was under the Germans. The blue, the bigger part, was under the Italians. Greece is the only power that pushed out an Axis power. They pushed out the Italians. And when that happened, then the Germans took over the blue part. The Germans took control of Epirus and Yanina in the autumn of 1943. Notices were posted for all the Jews to report to the mayor's office. Many young men had left for the resistance, but they were convinced to come back for their families, by their families, because their families thought they would be safe, thought that they wouldn't be deported. But in fact, they really didn't realize what had happened in Salonika 5 months earlier. But nonetheless, on March 25th, 1943, 90% of the Jews of Janina were collected and moved out. Actually, what happened also is that the transport went from Janina over the mountains. These are high, high mountains, to Larissa. At Larissa, about half a dozen men escaped and went to the partisans. They were able to escape from wherever the camp they were in. The deportations to Auschwitz then were carried out from Larissa. After World War II, about 200 Jews returned to Janina. Approximately 1,800 Jews were deported. Approximately 180 people returned back to Janina from the camps. Other people hid in villages. Other people were in the resistance. And they survived to come to a very strife-filled city. This was an area in which the Greek Civil War really was quite strong. Many of the Jews found that Greek Christians occupied their homes and their businesses. And even though legislation had been passed regarding the return and restitution, there was conflict about it, and it was not an easy exchange or return. The synagogue outside of the fortress had sustained damage in bombing raids and was demolished. The synagogue inside the fortress had been used by the Nazis as a warehouse, and in fact, the mayor of the city is credited. I don't know if it's apocrypha or if it's absolutely true, but he was credited of saving the Judaica, of hiding it and saving it and saying, these are our city treasures. So after the war, Jewish life slowly was recreated in Janina as the survivors remained there, or some left for Athens, Israel, the United States. Between 1946 and 1947, there were 36 weddings in Janina. And in this instance, there was then mixed marriages where Jews from Janina were marrying Jews from over the mountains, were marrying the Spanish Jews. And a tradition in Janina, well, there's a cake that's traditional in the Balkans, it's called a pan de span, Spanish bread, and it's a white-covered cake. And one of the brides told me that, actually, she's my age, she's younger than me, so it's not this time period, that when she got married, it was the mother-in-law, her son, married to Larissa. They went over the mountains taking a pan de span, because that's what you take for an engagement. When they got to Larissa, they were said, why do you have that? That's what you bring for a funeral. So between the communities, there were cultural traditions that were different. Several of the marriages, as I said, were from women from other communities. They were usually arranged through matchmaking, meeting at weddings, and so forth. The community began to grow. In March 1948, there were 22 children, four old enough to begin schooling. By 1950, there were 66 children, 36 boys, 30 girls. And you didn't get an aleph. I thought you were going to get an aleph. There was a certain type of written amulet called an aleph that was used to protect particularly a boy child at birth. In 1967, there were about 92 members in the community. I was there in the early 80s, and the number had dropped to 70 or 25 families. There were two children born that year. By the 1990s, about 45 Jews remained in Janina. So let's walk through Janina. This is what it looked like in the 19th century. And this is actually the walled area. And you can see here that the water laps along the wall. In a more recent, but still old picture, you can see the land by the wall. This is very significant because on the Sabbath, after services, women, men, young people would go and walk around the molo, around the wall, around the area. But what's interesting is that in Greek villages, on Sunday after church, young people go out. Remember when it used to be bunches of boys, bunches of girls? And they'd walk, and as you walk down the street, you get to see who's out there, you know, who's that girl? And you could ask and so forth. And this is what the Jews would do on Shabbat. Historically, Yanina was comprised of a commercial market center with a civic administrative area. It is the provincial capital. And there were residential neighborhoods. The city had the citadel, the Castro, which was primarily residential. The nature of the urban synagogue is well is expressed well in Greek. Synagogue, syn, means together. So synikia means together, and the ancient Greek ikia, or houses, neighborhood, houses together, as the father in My Big Fat Greek Wedding would say, see, that's it. Anyways, the neighborhood is a residential quarter of the city made up of one street or a set of contiguous streets. And this is in, I think this is pretty close to the present, what it looks like around the clock tower in the center. I wanted to show you Mount Mitsikeli, which is on the opposite side of lake, which is 7,000 feet. This is in the summer. In the winter, it is pretty heavy snow. This is outside of the Castro, the streets leading up to the walled area. Modern apartment buildings, which have taken the place of single-family homes, follow this tight spatial pattern on the narrow streets. Some shops necessary to daily life, like the greengrocer, the bakery, and the coffee shop, are located in the neighborhoods. And again, this is a long view, and you can see outside the walled area how the city spreads outward. And this is looking towards the walled area. So this is the streets of it. The Jewish community had several neighborhoods. As I said, there were two synagogues. There was an inside synagogue and an outside synagogue. And the neighborhoods were, I have this so I can remember, sorry. I apologize. Here we go. This is, of course, the walled area, the Castro. This is the commercial area. But in here was, around here was Vakufika. Kondurioto went up to the hospital. This would be Livadiotis along the lakefront. And then there were two areas, the Mikri Ruga and the small and the Megali Ruga. Mikri in Greek means small, Megali means big. Ruga is from Italian, meaning twisted, narrow streets. And so, I have this figured out. The Megali Ruga is around here, and then this street right here is the Mikri Ruga. They're little, and they call them stenos, which means alleyways, because that's, in essence, what they are. The essence of these neighborhoods is that they were not totally Jewish. Christian and Muslim families also lived there. So this is a house in Kondurioto, and you see a Mogen David in there. This was built by a Jewish couple who had who were from New York, a Yanina couple from New York. And in the 30s, I believe, they emigrated back to their homeland. They built this home. They had American passports, but they were deported. It's hard to see, but there are Hebrew inscriptions, and one of these is the old age home, and one of them is the community offices and the club where young people got together to meet. To give you a sense of the streets from an old-time picture to a little bit more recent, this is 1983. Whoops, I always do that. 1983. They call these Turkish hanging out windows, the ladies, because they could sit there and gossip and talk to their neighbors without leaving the house. You know, you could talk to the lady right next door in the daytime. Again, to give you a sense of how narrow cobblestone the streets are, on Friday, on Shabbat, women would come out and they would paint the curbstone in front of their house white with whitewash, with lime. And these are called frida, which means eyebrows. It's very interesting because I live in Miami Beach now, and one of the characteristics of Art Deco in Miami Beach are eyebrows above the windows. So the use of language. Shopping looks like, just to give you a sense of the market. And here we are going to go down a narrow street and enter the Castro. Some of the entrances are straight, some have corners in them, you have to walk around. And we are going to go, we're going to go inside this house, which is the home of David John Matathias, who was a used clothing guy, like the old Army Navy store, had used clothes. I never knew how to call him by his name because everybody called him, his nickname was Laios. Laios means wolf because he wasn't thought to be a very honest dealer. This is the old family home in the Castro. And when you enter the front door, you enter a courtyard. And opposite the entry in the courtyard is this building, which is the kitchen. So that you don't catch, kind of like pioneer homes in this part of the world, so you don't catch your house on fire. This is the steps that goes to the living quarters on the second floor. The climate's pretty much like this is. So homes have a very ornate, stuccoed fireplace. And on the door, you see these greenery thingies hanging there. This is the pieces of the lulav, the willow, the palm, and the other branches. The lulav. And after Sukkot, they're nailed onto the doorposts on the inside of the house. Now, I don't know if you know, but many Catholics and Orthodox Christians take their palms and their pussy willows and they make them into little pictures and things and they hang on to them. And on Ash Wednesday, they're burnt to make ashes. In Yanina, this is not a Yanina picture, I just took those off the web. Those pieces from the lulav are kept all winter and burned in the fire when you're making the matzot at the bakery. I don't know if it's a direct sharing, but it's interesting. In the Matathia house, this is looking out over the rooftops of the old city, of the Castro, to the mountains. And now let's go to the synagogue. There were two synagogues and two minyans. Each of the synagogues had a smaller building structure to it. None of the minyans survived. This was when, you know, for the daily services, when it was just a few men, so they didn't have to open the whole building. The older synagogue, which is this one that we'll be entering, is the Kahal Kadosh Yashan, the ancient community located in the fortress. Legend dates the early synagogue, this synagogue, to the 9th century. There's a lot of legends there. It was rebuilt in the 18th century and again in 1829. The wall and the gate and the courtyard were built in the late 19th century. And we see some typical features when we go in. There is a permanent sukkah. And this is the door through which the men entered. I was not able, and I didn't copy, I apologize, but around the side of the building is the entry for the women. The women's, when I was there, the women's area was not used anymore because it was unstable. In the Sephardic tradition, there's the echal on one side with a reader stand in the center. This is the ark with the parochet drawn aside and the Torah's intiques. And the bima on the opposite end. So again, you see the reader stand and the bima from which the Torah would be read. And you see the flagstones that the Jews were pounding on that Ali Pasha was so alarmed about. No, this is the same as the Sephardic, as opposed to the Ashkenazic. In the Ashkenazi, there's the Hechal and the Bima is right there, one thing. So just to give you a sense of the synagogue again, the seating arrangement is along the central axis, east-west. So the men kind of had their backs to each other. This is the prochet, and you'll see the and note the gold embroidery on that, because that's significant. It's gold embroidered velvet. Here we have Mr. Cohen, Mr. Kantos, and Makis opening the Torah, the Echal. When you pass the Torah, women actually touch the teak and put their hands to their eyes and kiss their hands. And here we are on the bima itself, oops, with the Torah open. You can see the silver work, and then coming back down. This gentleman served in the communist guerrilla movement, and because the communists were especially persecuted after the Civil War, he wouldn't tell, you know, I asked him, he wouldn't, he said, no, I won't talk about that. Reading the Torah at the reader stand, the girls, and like most girls, they sit there and talk and gossip. This is a photo by Vince Giordano, who the late Vince Giordano, who also had a Fulbright to document the community. And this gives you a sense of the old and the 1980s, or actually 2006, Vince Giordano. Now, there's an interesting occurrence in Yanina. You see these silver kind of looking things on the parochet. And some of them were also put on belts, more or less, and hung along the side of the wall of the synagogue. There's silver plaques engraved in Hebrew. Wait, I know I have it. This one says that an ornament, a cloth, and a Torah scroll were dedicated to the death of a son and daughter. May their souls be bound on the bonds of life in serene rest together with all the saints in the Garden of Eden. It was dedicated at Shemini Atzeret in 1690. This one is dedicated to protect a young man to the old holy congregation, this synagogue, in 1761. These plaques, the 1811 one, was donated with a mappah, a cloth that's put on the reader's stand, in honor of the rabbi and his wife, and the one on the right was dedicated to a young man. The one in the center, where were these plaques put together to make a belt. Here we have a string of them. Here we have what are called tamata. They're ex votos used in the Greek church. When you have a problem with your leg, you go to this saint, or your ear to that saint. The picture I had doesn't, the only one I know is eyes is St. Barbara. And if you need help with your sailboat, if you're fishing, yeah, I think it's St. Nicholas. And I think they're totally related, that this custom in the Greek to being with the Jews of Yanina. This doesn't seem to exist anywhere else in Greece, this practice. I believe the synagogue in Machne Yehuda has these in them when you're there next. Okay? So let's talk about some traditional culture now that you've been washed over with tons of history. Jewish traditional culture is preserved in two separate periods of celebration, the life cycle and the cycle of festivals. And we find patterns that are repeated. We find customs that are the same, customs that are different. A custom that is the same across most Jewish communities is the wedding contract, the ketubah. But let's look at the wedding and the wedding in Yanina. And what I'd like to do is first introduce you to Janet Sito. She is the grandmother of the director of the Jewish Museum of Greece. And she wrote about her sister's wedding. She told me this. For a man to marry a girl in Yanina, She had to be a good housekeeper and have money. And my father considered 40,000 drachmes and her prika, her dowry, because ours was a good family. In the 1980s, a prika, the money was 1,000,000 drachmes in an apartment. I was at my cousin's apartment, and I asked him something. I said, "Oh, your house is very nice." He says, "It's not my house, it's my wife's." So it's very well known. First, the family of the groom gathered their relatives, some 40 people, and they went to the bride visiting all together in the house of the bride. They went to the good room, the saloni. Everyone sat, and later the bride greeted all the relatives. First, she kissed the hands of the mother-in-law. Afterwards, she went to the groom. The groom kissed her and gave her a heavy gold necklace. After that, she greeted all the relatives, and she offered a sweet. At the end, she offered a whitened bread, this pan de pan. This is showing she's a good housewife. She has good skills. Later, the relatives of the bride went to the groom, but the bride's relatives didn't have to take such gifts, only a ring, something good to the groom. That was the engagement. So we have money, and we have a dowry, and we have serving, a ritual serving of stuff, food. Later was the wedding. It took 1 week. So for the wedding, they got the bride's prika, her dowry, lots of dresses, lots of pillows, mattresses, quilts. 2 days before the wedding, they went to the prika. Young people went. They took a pillow, a blanket, and the men worked as porters because they carried it all from the bride's home after it was measured so it could be written in the ketubah. It was taken from the bride's home to the groom's home. After the next day were the dances called the wedding dress of the bride. Two or three seamstresses came together. They cut the wedding dress, everyone danced, and they began to sew. On the evening of the next day, they had to have completed the wedding dress. And the wedding was on the next day, usually a Friday afternoon. The groom went first to the synagogue. In front of the groom, ahead of the groom, were as many relatives and as many of his people. They went together with violin, the orchestra. They needed you. They sang on the street, and they went to the groom. Later, the violin went, returned, and took the bride with all the relatives of the bride. Afterwards was the wedding, the readings. They returned to the groom's house, and there was a dinner, and that was the wedding in Yanina. In the evening, they had violin. There was a clarinet, a violin, and a bouzouki. And they partied all night. That's the night after the wedding, the night after. The orchestra played for the sirto, a Greek dance, not European, popular dances. They danced holding hands in circles. You know, the wedding was very lovely in those past years. And I remember there was an inviter. They didn't send invitations like now. A man came, and he went to invite all the families who were written in paper. So we've got different elements. She doesn't mention that usually the family of the bride gave the groom a Purim Megillah, and there is one here on display. The silver work was done in Yanina, not only silver filigree, but repoussé work, and I'll show you what that is in a second. The sweets. I'll tell you guys, I don't know how I found this online. I was going to take a picture of mine. Of course, it has to be a silver tray, and there's a picture out there of the Pizzarillo family. I think it's in the second case, in the early 20th century, and two of the grandsons, Sammy, and I forget his brother's name, they would now be in their 60s. They're children of Holocaust survivors, were silversmiths when I lived there. So you have a silver tray, of course a beautiful doily that the bride made, Greek coffee, which is ritually served with water, and a sweet that's called glikotu koutaliou, which is literally soup, a sweet of the spoon, spoon sweet. This is repoussé work, where it's beaten out and the pattern rises from the silver. And this is the kind of work that the Pizzarillo boys, they're old men now, do. And usually it was served with this koutalothiki. You can buy this on Etsy. I was never more surprised. But with, it should be sterling silver, hand-wrought spoons and forks, and this container. And also, a number of years ago, I was at the Gulbenkian Museum in Portugal. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. I recommend it, in Lisbon. And there was one of these there, but it was French. And I tried to get information about it, but was unable to. But the sweet would be in a glass vessel in here. and how the bride serves it and so forth, she's judged on it. I mentioned the gold chain, the chrisa cadena. It's kind of hard to see, but in these family pictures, the women are wearing their chrisa cadena, their gold chain, which is part of the gift from the groom's family to them. And I wonder, it's very interesting, I don't know when it was, maybe 15 years ago, I was in Rhodes, which had a significant Jewish community, a Sephardic Spanish community, and I was with a Dutch friend, and we saw a wedding. You know, we saw a car with crepe paper and everything drive by, and my Dutch friend said, look, it's a wedding. And as we climbed into the citadel of Rhodes, where there's still two mosques, the wedding was in one, or they had gathered, stopped at one of these mosques. And I thought it was a civil wedding, because in Greece now you can get married in a civil wedding. And so I went up to the gate, and I said, what's going on? They said, oh, it's a wedding, baba. And I said, is it civil? They said, no, it's Musliman. And there's 5 days to a Muslim wedding sometimes. And one day, I don't know how to say this politely, I translated from Greek, they hang the gold on the bride. And she stands there like this, and they just... And I wonder if this gold chrisa cadena is something that came from the Ottomans to the Jews in Yanina. I don't know, but it'd be kind of interesting. And the gold embroidered cushion would often be part of the dowry that the bride brought. And the importance of this is that at the time of the circumcision, your son would be seated or laying on this cushion. Eventually, this cushion would be opened and hung in that good room in the Saloni, which is covered with plastic wrap, and nobody sits there ever. And it's a part of the dowry. So another component was the mattresses. I mean, this sounds very weird, but you just didn't go to Mattress King or anything. This is an area rich in sheep, and the mattresses were made out of wool. So as Michael Matas told me, this was included in the marriage, in the ketubot. They made the mattresses with wool. The quilts were with cotton, the best quality. They weren't fixed, they were fixed outside of the home. They brought the mattress maker, and they took 1 week to fix it all in the house. They bought the fabric, they bought the cotton, they bought the wool over a period of years. And when the girl became engaged, they went to Drabatova, and we'll go there soon, and they cleaned the wool. And all the relatives went with sweets, with boats, and so forth. Mrs. Tsitos also talks about the cleaning of the wool and the party that's made and everything. And actually, many immigrants brought their wool mattresses with them to America. In Miami, there's a lady, Ray Yamali, and her mother brought the wool mattress. And at one point, I brought something. At one point, she was breaking down her home. She said, Annette, I don't know what to do with the wool. And I said, I want some for my daughter, because my grandmother's apparently with fires in the Lower East Side had been lost. And I sent a package to the Jewish Museum of Greece, because I think it's a very significant story that immigrant women carried this huge mattress and pillows stuffed with wool. And this kind of cut velvet is really considered high class taste. But she gave me the pillow, and I put the mattress. So this is, it's uncarded, unbleached wool from Yanina, from probably the 20s, part of this dowry that's a real life thing. So the ketubah in Yanina. The dowry was recorded in the ketubah. From the first, there were the celebrations of the prika on Wednesday. The prika decorated the whole house, the megillah and everything. And the dowry, as you know, is a document that records the obligations, financial and personal, which the husband undertakes towards his wife in respect of and consequent to their marriage obligations and so forth. In Yanina, which it's called a priko symphono, because the Christian girls also have this symphono, agreement, priko, what's coming into the wedding. It says that it's stipulated that the woman, if she is predeceased by her husband, She could bequeath part of her possessions as a gift to any of her relatives, and that her husband had no claim or share to it. This custom dates from the Byzantine period, when the dowry reverted to the bride's paternal family. There are two mid-19th century ketubot at Yanina that are discussed in an article, and everything's spelled out. The objects include a diamond ring, a silver goblet, a wooden bed, the pillow covers embroidered with the gold, bend linens, other kinds of clothes, a fur jacket. And these were probably upper-class families. And in the upper-class families, the highest priority was, or in all the families, the highest priority was the girl's virginity, which, of course, is a long tradition to that, but also a tax of 2% of the dowry, of the value of the dowry, was donated to Nesse Yetamot, the Society for Poor Girls, so that the poor girls could have dowries. Now, I mentioned the violin. These are two more Yanina ketubot. Not a lot of artistry in them. The previous one has allusions to horoscope figures, which is very traditional in a lot of ketubot. But I mentioned the music. Let's not go there yet. And there's a saying in Yanina. It says in Greek, "Horis rinko zalinko ke kulios, evre den ekanan alios." It's Greek to you, yeah? Without rinko, zalinko, and kulios, the Jews didn't do anything. We had one who played instrument. They called him Kulio, a gypsy. He made rhyming songs, very nice. And one midwife. She helped the ladies give birth. And a seamstress. There was a song, the Jews without Zalinka. Zalinka was the midwife. Kulio and Rinko, the seamstress. Without them, the Jews didn't do otherwise. In other words, the three were indispensable. So part of the Jewish wedding was tied up with this trio of characters who were not Jewish. And it was felt they were indispensable. Also, it's interesting because they say that the night of the wedding, they sang and everything, but the next morning, Kulios would come back with his band, and they made up specific mandanadas, rhyming songs about the couple. Anna Caravelli writes in the island of Karpathos, Friday afternoon, that also after Greek Christian weddings, these mandanadas were made up, rhyming songs about the couple. Is this a cultural sharing? We don't really know. Esther Rinko, when I started asking about her, I met her in 1984, Ekaterina Despotou, very elegant, well-spoken, elderly woman who had memories. She got her first sewing machine from a Jew who loaned her the money so that she could then have her business. One more thing about the Jewish wedding. There were rituals. Now, this is a patriarchal, patrilocal, scientific terms. It's a male-centered, and the bride went to live at her husband's home. So we have this relationship between the bride and her mother-in-law, whose home she's living in. So first of all, sometime during the week after the wedding, the bride had to fix rice to show she could clean it and cook it. And gold florins, or coins, liras, were put into the rice to wish good luck and many children. This is also a Greek Christian tradition at weddings. Then the next test was the Shabbat loaves. On Thursday night, everybody got together, and she starts to make the zimari, the dough. And she wants the covering, which they call misala. And this is the kitchen. So remember the kitchen, and the house is over here. And the bride would be in there making her, these are just off the web, making her chalot, and she'd say, "Mother-in-law, bring me the misala. Bring me the misala." And finally, she would bring the misala. Who's in control? The mother-in-law. And then the next day, the bride had to make fish. The groom, and this is, was in the 80s still a pattern that followed. The men often did the shopping because the women were housewives. They took care of the house. So the groom went to the market and he bought fish. It was the custom, and it was fish from the lake. And then he came, and he came back, and he says, oh, there weren't any fish. And what? Well, they were finished. No fish. But the fish was hidden. And when the bride came into the kitchen, he throws a live fish at her so that he's in control, too. And you have this charade going on in the week after the wedding. Now, there's all sorts of holidays going on. And let me speak about language for a minute. And as I said, these people spoke Greek. And you heard that in the little rhyme that I said. The Jews of Byzantium used the Greek language for sacred and intellectual literature. Hebrew was a liturgical language. But there was linguistic assimilation that the Jews then used Greek as their lingua franca. And the teachers of the Alliance were a bit shocked by this, that Jews spoke Greek, but that's what it was. It was their maternal language. And maybe the lack of a distinct vernacular plays a role in this cross-cultural sharing in the community. There was a holiday in Yanina that ended after the war, and it was called Irtaman. And I don't know if this is a corruption of Erchome, which means I'm coming. It means I'm coming. And the first, I only remember the first verse. And listen to this. It says, Irtaman keka, you don't understand. You'll understand words. Irtaman kekalas esfrikaman, Torah torosh hodesh, dekapendestopurim, ketriandestazimaria. So there's Hebrew embedded in this. And he's saying, and I think this is like trick and treat. Remember when we used to say, trick and treat, smell my feet, give me all the treats to eat, and, you know, if you're not good, we'll make bad. Kids don't say that anymore. You know, we used to have devil's night and stuff. But it's the same thing. At this holiday, the kids would go house to house, and they would beg for treats, a walnut, a penny, a dime, and so forth. This was 15 days before Purim at the new moon of Adar. So is this related to opening Adar with festivities? The first of Adar, who knows? But what's interesting is one of the treats was a roll with a hard-boiled egg in it called fulares. Well, the Christian kids before Easter sang kalinda. They'd go house to house. They didn't have the we'll be mean to you if you're not good to us, but they'd collect treats. And one of those treats was a bread with the egg baked in it. This holiday doesn't seem to be anywhere else. I've published about it. Nobody's written back and said, we do it here, we do it there. We don't know. I told you I'd take you to Drabatova.
So the holiday that they are going to the house, when they are drinking?
First of Adar. Before Purim. So, Drabatova, a very well-known anecdote in the community was about Naum Matzes. There's a lot of families named Matzes, but Naum was the patriarch of one of them. He made and sold dairy goods, the best in town. And his shop was located near, but not the lakefront. So once, when Yanina was still Turkish, in 1905, 1906, my father's friends wanted to do something, to go and party in Drabatova. You know where Drabatova is, across from the island. That's where there's coffee shops now. Drabatova, they think, comes from the Slavic language, meaning good water. Who knows? And they went to the store and they said, Naum, if you'd like, let's go party. And my father said, how can I leave my work? I have so much milk to fix. Cheese, yogurt, I'm responsible, I can't. Oh no, you'll come, we'll get you, you've got to come. Because the rest of the gang will be there, so you've got to come. And he said, if you can bring the boat here, outside the store, I'll come. So they left, and they brought a big cart with four wheels and two horses. They put a boat on it, a big one from the lake. They brought it, they also brought musical instruments in the boat, and they brought it outside my father's store in Cormagnon. My father scarcely realized it. He was caught. Since he had said what he said, that if you brought the boat here, I'm forced to keep my word at once. Amesos. He was wearing an apron at work. He took off the apron, shouted at the house. You know, they lived upstairs. He said, Mom, come here to the store with the staff. The milk has to be fixed. You oversee the store. I'm off to Drabatova with friends. There was a Jew who sang very, very well. Chacham Siambul, they called him. There was another, Turk, who had a high position in Yanina, Ali Dabu. There was an old bachelor, good man. He was never married at all, Meyer Dostis. And others whose names I don't remember. They went to Drabatova and they partied for 8 days and 8 nights. My father's stores brought wine. Other people brought food. They had roast lamb. Everybody's partying. Finally, they just finished. They were very tired, and I should say, they just were tired out from the party. They stayed out all night. Then they had to return to Yanina. And this is a culturally mixed group, ethnically mixed group, leaders of the community, the men partying together. Another activity actually brought, and this is a school kids from the Alliance, but gives you the sense of the boat. Another activity drew community members, Greek and Christian, to Drabatova. There's a, I don't have the better word for it, a thing called molybdomancia, which is a technique of fortune-telling using molten lead. Have you ever heard of this? You melt lead and you drop it into water and it makes a shape. Actually, I did work with Italians in Cleveland, and they did this. And because there's a spring at Drabatova, and apparently this is what the lead looks like, because of the spring, people would cross the lake to do this fortune-telling to make sure they didn't have the evil eye, tomati. Lead was dropped in the water, and the answer lay in the shapes of it. And so what I think you see is this long history of this community, which has been an urban community, very urban in its nature, and also multicultural in its nature. If you'd like, is there time? Should I introduce you to a few more people? This is Mrs. Tsitos, as we heard, and this is her when she came back from the war. Samuel Cohen at the Reader's Stand, who was a leading community member, a longtime furniture store man. Allegra Matzes, Allegra and I share a birthday, same year, same date. It's so much fun. She was educated in Greece. She went to Israel. She married another Yanina boy in Israel, and it didn't work out, so she came home. Her father was the lay scholar of the community. He wanted to be a teacher, but he had to take over the family's house goods store because of his older brother died. This is the father's home, and Allegra's sister, Tula, restored it into a bed and breakfast. Tula, if you saw My Big Fat Greek Wedding with Nicky, there's a Tula in there too. Tula's name is Diamante, Diamantula. And when you call your kid down the street, you don't say Diamantula, you just call Tula. These are diminutive nicknames. They get you in trouble. There was Aiki. Aiki could be Thanasaiki or whatever. When I was there, there was a guy, Isaiki, Itzak, Isaiki. On Thanasaiki's name day, because the Christians go around and celebrate name days, they came to his house, because nobody knew his name was Isaiki, Isaac. They thought he was Thanasis. This is actually a distant cousin of ours, Joseph Cohen. And if you could imagine, his nickname was Kokino. People had paratsukli, or nicknames, primarily men. Often they were, as I said with Mr. Matathias, laios. They attested to characteristics, to business dealings or something, or to a characteristics of your behavior. But they could also refer to physical characteristics. So he was called Red. And my grandfather had red hair, so we have red hair in our family. This is Kiriakula, and one of my areas of interest is food traditions, and kaltsonaikia, or like turnovers, are a food. I must say I don't remember what she was making, but I sat with her one day as she was making in her kitchen the kaltson. What's very interesting is most of these ladies had a gas or electric stove, And they also had like a double or three burner on legs. Most of the cooking was done on the burner because gas and electricity was much more expensive than having the butane in the burner. However, when you cooked your food and it was in a tapsi or a round pan like this, we don't use round pans, we use square pans that fits into our square ovens. You would take your tapsi to the neighborhood bakery and they would bake it. Your meat, your roasts, your bread, your calzon. One of the ladies who had the greatest sense of humor, she had sent her husband Isaac in the morning with and the men take these to the bakery, and he came home with the wrong one because he didn't know what he had taken. I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Kantovs. He was the last tinsmith in Janina. And at about this time, he was pretty much, rather than making new goods, was repairing the tinware used by people in the villages. And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for your attention and for supporting this marvelous program. Any questions? Yes, sir. There's a microphone. I think they want to.
The Detroit Institute of Arts gets a painting at Jewish Women of Janina. Are you aware of that?
Absolutely not. Do you know the artist?
No.
Oh, I'll write and ask them. Cool. Microphone.
Hey, who is here?
No, they need it for recording.
I have one comment and one question. As for the very beginning, I don't know if you know about this, I think it's already 8 or 9 years, the founding of the Etches Synagogue in Saranda, which is, in a way, get you back to your myth of, or the remains of the myth of the
Saranda in Albania.
Yes.
No.
So this is archaeologists from Tel Aviv University together with archaeologists of the Academy of Science of Albania, and they found a 4th, 5th century Byzantine synagogue in Saranda. So this is very close to the Greek border and not so far from Janina, I think, with mosaics and all kinds.
Wow.
Another slide here. And the question is if you can tell a little bit, I mean, I heard about the Nusa, the Sidur, the different kind of prey. But okay, I didn't get any touch of it,
You didn't.
Can you say something about it? I mean,
I have to pledge that there are certain areas into which I didn't delve as a researcher because of lack of knowledge, and I felt that I wouldn't do it justice. One was the Holocaust. Dr. Walter and I have been talking about that. I don't read Hebrew, so I didn't get into religious rituals or customs. I referred to Joseph Matza, Legra Matzis's father, and he has written about the Piyutim, because there were apparently distinct Piyutim in Janina. But it's an area I didn't delve into because I didn't want.
Do you know when you were talking with them if they were still praying in this Nusa or not?
No, I don't think so. I think that after the war and after the war, many of the prayer books came from the joint distribution committee. Or they would get Sephardic Rite books rather than Musaf Romaniot.
My guess is that in Oel Moshe, in Jerusalem, with the near Mahdi Yehuda, maybe the last remain. But again, I don't know.
I think in New York they follow it, but I'm not sure. But also in New York they use the prayer books from the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue on Central Park West. Yeah. No. Yeah. But, you know, as a scholar, you kind of make choices partly out of laziness. And I'd be very curious to know about responsa from that area, because so much of the scholarship about Sephardic Jews is about quaint customs, but not delving into the religious history. So that's not been part of the scholarship, but I think that's being remedied. Yeah, sure. There's a question in the back. Lady from Janina, the name of the painting?
Yes, I remember the Jewish woman of Janina.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. I don't know if this would be directly related, but recently the news reports, as you know, the Greek economy is in trouble, and that has, I guess, given rise to groups, identity groups like the Golden Dawn, which may, at least in Athens, I hear, might be enjoying 25% support. Is the community of Janina directly affected by that?
I want to tell you I don't know. I know that in the past 10 years there's been destruction or graffiti at the cemetery, but the cemetery has been declared a national treasure, and I think it's getting more preservation. That's not answering your question. I do not know about activity of the Golden Dawn in Janina. There's about 5,000 Jews in Greece now. They're extremely low-keyed and want to keep a very quiet status quo. If you go to Amsterdam, if you go to Paris, and you try to find a Jewish communal building, it says it all over there. If you want to go to the joint or the community, the central organization of Jews in Athens, you have to know the exact address, the exact floor you're going through, and you go through security. They're very, very quiet and trying to stay out of the way of trouble. But I don't know the full extent of the Golden Dawn.
Yeah. While you were talking, I was looking a little bit on Hebrew sites. On Hebrew sites, so this event that you were just described is 2009, so that was quite a cruel attack on the Jewish cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Using also blood of turtles and all kind of destructions and so on.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Again, I really thank you for your attendance, for your interest in the subject matter, for honoring the professor who left this bequest and whose honor this is continuing in. It's a interesting, unique history here at Michigan State University. Thank you. No, the brides came. It was mostly men who married girls from other towns. So the girls came into the city. When I lived there, there were three girls from Larissa, and the first one arranged for the second one, arranged for the third one. The third one was the youngest, Mrs. Tsitos' son, and his bride, Janina, is Isihia. It's very easygoing. It closes up at 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. There's not a lot of clubs and parties, and poor Layla hated it. It's like, so boring here. And they actually moved back to Larissa, also partly because they had a child and he could get a better Jewish, he could get a Jewish education in Larissa. It just depended on the character of the girl, if they liked it or not. Because it's really a quiet city.
If
if you look for traces of this somewhat distinctive subculture or culture in other towns, would you find it Janina-like cultures in some of the other towns?
You might find it in families, in Athens. Actually, if you've been to Athens, at the end of Monastiraiki, the flea market, is where the synagogue is, right before you get to Keramikos, the old cemetery. Across the street from the synagogue is a Yanina synagogue, which the Yanina Jews early in the 20th century founded, and they keep that up. So my cousin, we're Yaniotes, but his father and mother had their business in Corfu. But his wife, I think Annie's family is from Salonika. But their kids have know both the both traditions from both, but it's also modern world too. And their one son who's an architect in London married an anthropologist from Japan. She's very interested in our heritage and learning more and learning to cook and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see. My daughter is very aware of our heritage, even though she's only one quarter Greek Jewish, because my husband's an Ashkenazi Jew. But she's very aware. She's very aware of that. And when she was a kid, we went in Oklahoma City to a Greek festival. We went in the church, and she goes, "Mommy, we're Greek too." And actually, in high school, I remember there was a discussion in class about how many, I forget how it came up, about who was Greek in the class. And there was one girl, then there was Daryl Stein, whose grandfather was from Salonika. And Miriam wouldn't speak up, my daughter wouldn't speak up, and she's more Greek than Daryl is. So, but she knows what her heritage is. It just depends on family who passes it on. Again, thank you so much.